Well, here we are back again. This is the second installment of Epiphany, our podcast for July 14th, which is neat. Contents on this include the author's notes, our feature chapter 2 of Epiphany, and a preview of next week's chapter, and a bit more about the contents of this week's cast, which you are hearing now. Last week started with a fire at the Magnolia Community Church at 3 in the morning. Church pastor Dan Stevens was already having doubts about his ministry and ready to quit before he could say anything about it. His friend and mentor, Magnolia's chief of police, Harold Richmond, reminded him that when one door closes, another window opens. Dan then goes home with his daughter and family dog for a time of healing. Chapter 2. Dan was nearly overwhelmed by the outpouring of support of the week following the fire. When he wasn't taking another phone call offering to help, he was dealing with Sheriff Roy and the state fire marshal. After the fire marshal's investigation, it was determined that the fire was deliberately set. At Sheriff Roy's suggestion, the FBI was called in. Because a fire appeared to start in the pastor's study, Dan came in for an afternoon of intense questioning. An agent named Barada came in from Columbus to conduct the interrogation. Parts of Dan's life were stripped bare. His associations were questioned, examined, and re-examined. Certain habits were brought up. Habits Dan didn't want known, but at the same time, they could have been important. At the end of it all, it was concluded that he was actually more upset about losing the collection of books he inherited from Pastor Kello than he did about losing the entire building. "The house can be rebuilt," he told Agent Barada. "The wisdom contained in those books are lost forever." He thought about telling the G-man about the stranger at the fire. The thought was lost, though, in a flurry of questions regarding the incident. Dan was thankful that what weren't lost were the church records. Soon after celebrating the first anniversary of his arrival as pastor, Emily talked him into putting the information in the cloud in event of an emergency. Immediately after the fire, she resisted the urge to tell Dan, "I told you so." He knew what she was thinking, and he was thankful that she didn't verbalize her thoughts. Immediately after the fire, a question of, "Where do we hold services?" came up. The school board met in special session the afternoon of the fire and reluctantly offered worship space at the high school. Their reluctance had to do with an incident several years earlier when the board approved leasing worship space to another church group. A certain Miss Vera Mace felt that the Lord told her to stray from the assigned space one Sunday while the setup crew worked. She used that time to liberally spread chick tracts around the school. Students discovered the tracts on Monday morning, not knowing whether they were a joke or if they would go into the bowels of hell if they didn't repent right then and there. When the superintendent, Dr. Claude Pepper, found out about the tracts, he called the pastor on the carpet, tore up the lease, and told him never to darken the doors of the school again. Pastor Richards thumbed his nose at Dr. Pepper, pulled half a dozen trailers on a property 3 miles out of town, and started his own Christian school. When the school held an auction to raise money, Steve Mulligan donated a dozen cases of a certain soft drink just to get a reaction from the petulant pastor. As expected, there were a few choice words from the man of God making the morning rounds at Zeke's Cafe. The pastor and the superintendent eventually came to an understanding and buried the hatchet. Pastor Richards still wasn't allowed to use school facilities, however. Anyway, the Board of Education voted unanimously to allow Pastor Dan to use part of the high school for meetings on Sunday and Wednesday nights, provided there wasn't a game scheduled. The summer basketball leagues graciously juggled their own schedules to accommodate the church. Money was not a problem. There is still quite a bit of Katie Cole's seed money available to get the rebuilding process started in earnest. Offers of help came in from all over the county and beyond. To Dan, the most touching donation came from his daughter Gracie on the day of the fire. Soon after he got back to the house and briefed the family on the situation, Gracie disappeared for a short time, then appeared in the family room with her piggy bank. It's all I have, she told her father. He used her offer as a teaching moment about the widow's mite. Offers of help came from every corner of Fuller County. Gerald and Hank Windham at the lumberyard gave the church a blank check. You're welcome to any materials you need to rebuild at what it cost me, Gerald told Dan over lunch the day after the fire. And if we don't have it, we'll get it. Despite the outpouring of money and goodwill, Dan started to fall deeper into an abyss of despair about his faith. He went to the charred ruins of the church 2 days after the fire to see if anything could be salvaged. There was nothing left standing except for a woman in black. Miss Lizzie Elston from the bed and breakfast hovered near a section of the charred ruins, searching for something. Dan watched her for a few minutes, wondering what she might be seeking. He watched her from a discreet distance as she appeared to kick at some of the charred ruins with her feet, before bending down to sweep portions with her hands. After repeating the same action several times, she came back up, clutching what appeared to be a small object, which she wiped and inspected before putting it into her pocket. After several cycles repeating the same action, Dan's curiosity got the better of him. He approached the retired schoolteacher to ask her what she was doing. In case you have forgotten, she told him, this is where the front entrance of the church once stood. Just inside the door was the wall of honor. I'm seeing if I can recover the plaques on that wall before the trucks come to cart this place away. She showed him several of the small plaques she had already recovered. Each of them bore a name, year of birth, the years of service in the military, and, if appropriate, the year the honoree died. It became apparent to Dan that she might have been looking for one plaque in particular, one which might have had a special meaning to her. They sifted through the rubble together for just over half an hour. Each found plaque was shared, noted, and retained. Some Dan kept, some Lizzie kept. There were 40 plaques on the wall, Lizzie told the pastor. I can only account for 38 between us. There are two missing. Droplets of rain started coming down as she spoke. Dan looked at the sky to see what the droplets would soon become a steady shower. It was decided that the best thing for them to do would be to head for cover at the parsonage. They reached the house just after the skies opened up, enough to get wet, but not thoroughly soaked. I would think that both of you would have enough sense to get in out of the rain, Emily declared when they stopped in the foyer. Dan, go upstairs and get some dry clothes on. Miss Lizzie, come with me. Emily led Miss Lizzie upstairs to the spare bedroom, grabbing a pair of towels from the linen closet on the way. While the spinster took off what she was wearing, Emily retrieved a dressing gown from her bedroom. Lizzie dried off and put on the robe and explained why she was out in the rain with Dan. When she was warm and dry in the gown, she gathered the plaques she collected, then followed her hostess downstairs to the kitchen. While Emily put Lizzie's wet clothes in the dryer, Lizzie arrayed the plaques she collected in a paper towel to see what she had. Dan came down a few minutes later to join the women, adding his collection of plaques to Lizzie's. He went to the sink to get a washcloth along with a can of Bon Ami. You said between us we had 38 plaques out of 40, Dan pointed out when he returned to the kitchen table. Looks about right. They counted 38 plaques just to make certain. So we're still missing two, Lizzie said softly. For the next several minutes, Lizzie, Dan, and Emily cleaned the plaques enough to expose the names belonging to each of them. Lizzie wrote down each name, comparing them to a checklist she had in her head. You know that each of these has a story, she mentioned while they were taking stock. The honor roll, as we call it, started soon after World War I at the location. The church and grill, right? Emily asked, referencing the former church building in downtown Magnolia, which had been taken over and turned into a bar. Yes, that's where the original got started. The names on the original honor roll were painted directly onto a board and posted by the entrance of the church. When the Second War started, names were added. Just the names, nothing else. When someone died in action, the date would be added. Mike McChesney, who lived two doors down from this parsonage, was the first. He died in North Africa. Others followed. Lizzie scanned the name tags and produced the tag bearing Mike McChesney's name to show to Dan and Emily. When I came back home from after college to teach, I became interested in finding out more about the names of the men on the wall, Lizzie continued. By that time, the church had moved. The wall at the old place had been painted over, and the only record we had of the names on the old wall was from my mother. She thought enough to copy the names just before Ed moved in and remodeled the place. Dan was vaguely aware of some of the history of his church. He knew that attendance at the church had dwindled so much after the end of the Second World War that the building was sold and turned into a bar and grill. What was once a rough-and-tumble establishment softened over the years, becoming more family-friendly by the time he was growing up. Not long after the new building went up, the elders decided to build a new honor roll, Lizzie continued. My family donated the names and the money to make the wall a permanent fixture. I can understand why you're hunting for the plaques, Dan commented. Your family probably has a lot invested in that wall. Indeed, yes, the retired teacher smiled. More importantly, the community had a lot invested in that wall. Not in money, mind you, but in memories of those who served and those who were left behind. So there were 40 memorials on the honor roll, Emily said. We have 38. Do you know the names of the missing on the missing plaques? I believe one of them belonged to Thomas Frost. Tommy, Lizzie answered. He's still alive, living out in the western part of the county up by Jumpstart. He was a Marine in the Pacific Theater during World War II. I used to go visit him with... With who? Dan asked after her voice trailed off. She stared into space. Tears welled up in her eyes. Maybe it's better if you leave her alone for a while, Emily suggested. Dan took the hint and left the kitchen, leaving the memorial plaques on the kitchen table to be dealt with later. That's the end of chapter 2. Now, this week, again, we were reunited with the owner of the Blue and the Gray, Miss Lizzie Elston, and we're treated with a pair of side stories, which will come into play later as this story develops. We will, on chapter 3 next week, we've got some more about why Lizzie sort of shut up there toward the end of the chapter, and some more backstory for purpose of setting up what's going to be going on a little bit later on there. Bit late from what I intended to have this out. I was going to be recording this yesterday evening, Wednesday evening, July the 13th. And I was sidelined by what happened to me back in San Antonio past weekend. Woke up on a Sunday morning, found my car was gone. It has been since we've declared it, or we've had it stolen. I've replaced it just last night with something new to drive. In the meantime, the best laid plans of mice, as Douglas Adams would have said, were a bit different. I'd be remiss in my duty if I didn't say something about the Dallas shootings of the policemen last week. It's a darn shame. Peaceful protest with police and citizens who basically were united. Actually became a little bit more united because of a gunman who basically flipped his lid, at least the way I understand it. It was a shame that happened. The people that had that happen to them, just too terrible to contemplate. One other thing, and then we'll leave you. Back in Ohio, I found out that a friend of mine, Mike Smith, who was working at WBEX, WKKJ in Chillicothe for quite some time. In fact, I worked for him for a while. I had been let go of his job up with the people at Clear Channel, and he was, at the last time we saw it, basically he's out of work, just trying to contemplate his own fate at this time. That's really about it for the week. Mike, if you're listening, hey, this is the freebie. In the meantime, we'll be back next week. I'm B.D. Harrell. Be seeing you.